This episode is brought to you by Charcoal Book Club. Each month, Charcoal selects a first edition monograph that's a must-have for every photo book collection. Each book arrives signed by the artist with a print and a note card from the guest curator, not to mention free shipping to the US, Canada, and the UK. If you already have the book, you can simply swap it out for another one in their bookshop. Some of my favorite books in the past few months have been Half Story Half-Life by Raymond Meeks and Wood River Blue Pool by Joanne Walters. Many of the books of the month are now out of print and really expensive, but I have a copy thanks to the book club. Just one of the many reasons that I love being a member of Charcoal. Try it for yourself. Join the club at charcoalbookclub.com. I'm Jordan Weitzman, and you're listening to Magic Hour. There's so much soul in Mark McKnight's dark, complex, surrealist, psychological photographs. Whether he's photographing the bodies of men he's attracted to, still lives or landscapes, all of which have a distinct relationship to one another. Just last week, Mark was awarded the very prestigious Aperture Portfolio Prize. I encourage you to go read Brendan Emser's write-up because he really hits the nail on the head with Mark's work. Emser says, "Mark McKnight is a modern-day modernist. His black-and-white photographs of skin and sand, brick and tar, with their rich tones and sparkling light, are redolent of 20th-century masterworks. Those pictures by men like Edward Weston, who cast the world in silver gelatin." Weston once said the camera should be used for recording the quintessence of the thing itself, whether polished steel or palpitating flesh. But for McKnight, who was born in Los Angeles to a New Mexican Hispanic-identifying mother, something was missing from Weston's vision, something that would ignite a flame of recognition in a young queer man whose ideas about male beauty were more expansive than the Eurocentric standard, something that would make straight photography a little less straight. Mark and I got together at a studio in the Boyle Heights area of LA. We got to talking about another big part of his life, teaching, which he spoke about with the same enthusiasm and energy that comes through in his work.
There's like never an end to the things you could say about the topic, especially like when I'm teaching a history of photography class. And I taught two versions. I taught two separate classes this past semester. Yeah. And they were getting like different lectures. I would just start talking and then something would pop into my head and I would be like, well, you know, the interesting thing about this picture. And then suddenly I would be like, oh shit, I didn't say that to the other class.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like a fact they needed to know necessarily, but it was like something that I view in the work that I think would be valuable for mostly a room of non-artists
right.
to think about, because some of those things don't always come naturally to non-artists.
Yeah, and that can change every time you almost look at the picture, a testament to a picture's quality.
Yeah, and sometimes I'm discovering something while I'm talking, and of course you're like an instructor, and so you don't go, I've never thought about this, this is so crazy. You just start saying it like it's something you've always thought, but like you're kind of thinking like, oh my God, how did I not notice this about such and such's work? Stuff just kind of spills out on accident that is rewarding for you as an artist.
I'm just thinking about that excitement when you kind of don't get work, like you see work for the first time. I remember for me, Walker Evans comes to mind. Remember Stephen Shore looking at, you know, Uncommon Place and thinking like, these are like nothing. What are these?
Mm-hmm.
And then it detonates, or someone points something out to you, or you see something that you hadn't seen before, and it's just like, boom, like an explosion.
Opens a door in your brain.
It opens a door in your brain, and you almost can't even look at, you can't even imagine how you looked at it.
Or
almost
it creates,
boring kind of way, yeah.
It like opens the door, and the room is empty. Yeah. And then you want to fill that room with all kinds of other stuff that is related, and then you're like really curious.
Right.
Which, yeah, and that's really exciting.
Was there any work that was like that for you?
It's funny that you would say Stephen Shore. I saw, I think it may have just been called Uncommon Places at the Hammer Museum. I think I was maybe 20 or 21 or something. And I was a community college student.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been, it would have been before I even transferred to SFAI, I think. And I think that work, I haven't thought about this before. I think that work may be the reason why I started shooting
Stephen
large
Shore.
Format.
Really?
Yeah, it was the Stephen Shore show. Hmm. And then for a while, I think I was more attracted to the nostalgia of those photographs
mm-hmm.
than what they were actually designed to do.
Which he actually, you're right, which he can't stand.
Yeah. Yeah, but that opened the door to like new topographics and thinking, yeah, and thinking about all these other things. You know, like opened the door to that empty room, and then I filled that empty room with like thinking about new topographics, and then eventually going to a school that felt like, yeah, like new topographics.
Right.
And that was like all anyone could talk about. And it was sort of a happy coincidence or something that those were things I was interested in at that time, at least.
Hmm. I'm really curious about one of your teachers, Henry Wessel. Unfortunately, you know, he passed away recently. But I've always been such a Wessel fan. And I'm so curious what he was like as a teacher.
He was great. Yeah, he was really great. I think if I was to say like one thing about Hank that has like persisted, I mean, there's a lot of things, and I feel like probably so many things are unconsciously embedded in the way that I think about photography. But the thing that really resonates the most, and when I like really think about Hank, is like, I don't know, as an artist, you sometimes, in the middle of making new work, sometimes you start to like second guess what you're doing. And like, you start asking, or I start asking too many questions about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and how this is going to add up to such and such. And I mean, I did it even at like the undergraduate level when I was a student of Hank's, and I was like kind of new to using a 4x5 camera. The pictures are really clunky. I mean, you're looking at an image like upside down, like it's big, it's like, yeah, it's just a clunky camera to be using. And the pictures were not, looking back at them, he was really sweet and supportive, and but the pictures weren't that good. But he identified that I was looking at interesting things, and he just said, you're looking at all the right things, just keep making the pictures, make enough pictures, and eventually the pictures will tell you what they're about and what you're doing. And that was just like those things were really liberating when I was like afraid that I wasn't doing anything, that I was just taking pictures. And even now, sometimes when I'm making work, yeah, I find that I think about Hank, and then I think about just like trusting the process of making the pictures, and trusting that, like, yeah, I'm looking at the right things, and that I might not be consciously aware of what I'm doing, but that the pictures are going to tell me eventually if I just keep making them, which is a really good way of, for me, it's a really good way of making work. And I find like with younger artists that I know, sometimes they are really, they seem really like prematurely stifled. And it's something I like passing along to people, that like Hank Wessel nugget, because yeah, it kind of saved me in a lot of ways.
Well, it seems to me that that advice kind of epitomizes the thing that I find myself most interested in photography, which has to do with the manifestation of the unconscious. And this is something that is, it's like, it is so hard to tangibly grasp. And it's so hard, and I think it's why so many people get stifled, is because you can't really put a finger on it. But there is this thing that happens, and I'm curious how you feel about this. There is this thing that happens when, and it happens within all the arts, whether you pick up a paintbrush or a pencil or a camera.
Sure.
Where if you just do something in a very, very kind of playful way, things will come out that you could never have anticipated. There was this kind of belief that the whole Winogrand, Papa George, 70s street photographers believe that the world is always a lot more interesting than your mind. And there's something kind of to that, but to me, it's almost like it's half correct, that saying.
Agreed.
Because no matter where you are, whether you're in your studio or whether you're out in the world, it's this relationship between you and the thing you're dealing with that's going to bring something interesting out.
Yeah, absolutely. But also editing, that is your mind making very specific decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it's not like Winogrand or Friedlander was making one picture and that was the one that ended up on the wall. Like,
right.
Yeah, I'm always skeptical of that. Like, I don't have any agency here attitude. Like, I just went into the world and made the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I'm way more attracted to some of the things you were bringing up about the unconscious. And I feel like something I'm interested in is seeing the unconscious made manifest in a photograph. Mm-hmm. And then like seeing that reflected back somehow in a picture that I've made. Like, it's telling me something that I already knew, but I didn't know that I knew it. And it's important for me to know. That sounds ridiculous.
No, I mean, to me it makes complete sense.
And those are the pictures that I really love. Like, one of my favorite pictures ever, it's this Jacob Riis picture. It's called An Ancient Lodger and the Plank on Which She Slept. And it's this woman... It's this woman who is standing in the middle of the frame. Her feet are cut off. She seems to be like leaning off to the side or back. Her eyes are closed. And then the plank on which she slept is leaned against the wall just slightly behind her. And then it's made like Riis style with, you know, the like super bright magnesium flash. So there's this really harsh shadow. But then the other thing is that at the corner, the right corner of the frame, as you can see, the hand of the assistant who is releasing that flash. And so it's just like this weird, accidentally surreal photograph where you have a cut off hand, feet that are cut off at the bottom, and then this title that is suggestive of the fact that this woman is asleep, which is reaffirmed by the fact that her eyes are closed, but you also know that she's awake because she's standing there.
Right.
And it's like, it's just this, yeah, it's nuts. It's not designed to be a surreal photograph. I don't even know whether like Jacob Riis was the kind of photographer that would have identified those qualities, but it also seems to me like the kind of picture that someone could have cropped it into being a more documentary photograph,
mm-hmm.
but there's like the inclusion of that hand
mm-hmm.
and the accidental
right.
is great. And sometimes I'm not even sure if it's the accidental so much as the unconscious.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I guess they kind of both sort of go hand in hand. When I take pictures, I use a digital camera, and I feel that I need to take a lot of pictures. I need to play around by taking a lot of pictures in order for that kind of that unconscious to come out somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious how you do it. I mean, you shoot 4x5, you shoot large format,
mm-hmm.
you're taking very few negatives. How do you relate to that?
I'm just a genius of photography, and I walk up and I push the button one time and I don't look at the meter. No, I hate that when that like sort of romantic idea, like, I take a lot of pictures, and I was thinking about this the other day, like, I'm shooting 4x5. Very recently I started shooting, in the past I shot with a 6x9. Recently I started making some pictures with a 6x7 to get loose, but mostly I'm shooting with a 4x5. And recently I was like, should I try shooting 8x10? And then I thought about it and I realized that if I shot 8x10, that film is so expensive, and it just, there's something about that that just feels so much more precious, that I think I would make less pictures, or I would be so insistent on like hitting a home run every time mm-hmm. that there wouldn't be any room to make accidentally good pictures, or to like, yeah, or to like tilt the camera on its side, or do the kinds of things that almost inevitably are the better pictures. So, I mean, that's like a long-winded way of answering your question, but I make actually a lot of pictures. Like, and I don't know if you can identify with this, but like sometimes I can like smell it on the subject. Like, there's a picture here. I know there's a picture here. And it sometimes takes setting the 4x5 up 2 or 3 times to figure out what that picture is. And sometimes it takes making all of those pictures, processing the film, and then looking at them and figuring out which one of the pictures it is, if it's any of them. Sometimes, I didn't get it, and I learned from, which is a very Wessel thing to say, I learn from those mistakes, and then the next time the like universe presents that picture to me, which has happened on so many occasions, I know exactly how to make it.
Uh-huh. Do you ever feel like you might feel amazing, like in a moment taking a picture, and then going back and looking in, there's kind of like, you know, it doesn't compare to the actual feeling at the moment of making it. And the inverse also, you might kind of be feeling very little bit, and then boom, you kind of produce this amazing thing.
Sometimes it feels like, yeah, sometimes the picture feels like it's being handed to me, mm-hmm. and that it's like a requirement and not something that I even really had to work for. And I'm like, well, okay, I'll just take this picture. And then it ends up, yeah, it does something way beyond what I could have anticipated. And yeah, totally. I think I made some pictures last week that mm-hmm. were in the moment. I was like, this is my masterpiece. And then like 6 hours later, I was like, I don't know, I'm not sure about that. The film's sitting actually over there on top of that bag. I'll find out tonight and let you know.
Okay.
But of course, I won't even know tonight. It might not be for like a year or more mm-hmm. that I can really look at the pictures and be like, yeah.
Yeah. There's this video. There's this Wessel thing that I always think about. I must have watched this video, I don't know how many times.
It's my favorite video to show to students.
Do you? It's the video of him on YouTube. It's like this mini documentary.
Yeah. KCET.
Right.
Art Bound or something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And there's this one scene where he shows a stack of work prints for a year, which is maybe, I don't know.
It's like a pillar.
It's like a pillar. Yeah. It's probably like 3 to 5 feet high
of
prints. There must be, I don't know how many hundreds of prints in there.
Yeah.
And then he takes his fingers and he basically makes the size of, I don't know, a small coin. And he shows the section at the bottom of the stack of prints that might make the cut at the end of the year. And to me, that's one of the most inspiring things. I mean, seeing someone who is, you know, a masterful photographer, you know, a master of the craft, who makes such good work, showing you how it's so much about failure.
It's so much about failure, and it's also so much about being available.
Mm-hmm.
And or just having a desire and picking up the camera and pushing the button. I think he talks about it as saying yes.
Saying yes, yeah.
Yeah, and that too, the way that he talks about the joy of making photographs I really identify with too. But yeah, absolutely. It's nice to hear someone talk about failure, because when you go to an exhibition and you see all the work, and there's not of his work specifically, but anyone's work, it's just, you're seeing like this fraction of all of their labor and curiosity. And, you know, if you're like new to this thing, you see those pictures and you might feel a little bit like, I'm not naturally good enough to make 10 incredible pictures like that in a month or 6 months or a year. And then you see a video like that where someone like Hank is talking about how many.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing about him too, though, is I suspect a lot of those quote unquote failures would be a lot of other people's successes.
Probably.
But yeah, it's cool when I like, always like that.
Yeah. I'm curious about, you got really into new topographics early on, and that's what inspired you to kind of, that's what inspired the format of
making large format color pictures.
Right. Making large format color pictures. Now you're making black and white pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Your recent bodies of work are made up of landscapes and human figures, mostly men, that have a very kind of surrealist tone to them. How did you arrive at the subject matter that you wanted to deal with?
Hmm.
And the way that you wanted to deal with it?
How far back do I go? Let's see. So like in undergrad, I went to SFAI I went to the San Francisco Art Institute, which is a school that, it's the first fine art photography program, I think, in the United States. It was founded by Ansel Adams. It was, early faculty, it was like Weston, Minor White, really kind of F64-y. So straight, quote unquote, straight photography. Right. I think that that early interest later manifested in this thing I said, which is like new topographic, still kind of quote unquote straight photography, except a little bit more like neutral or detached in appearance. So that's sort of like early education stuff. The other, I mean, I haven't even figured out how to talk about this yet, really. So I should also say I'm in this crit group. It's like I'm the next round, and I've started to think about my personal history in relation to my practice, and that has opened up all these avenues in which to think. And I more recently, the shift happened, I think, when I came out in to some degree. And I,
how old were you?
I think I was 26 or 27.
26. Okay. I thought I was a late bloomer, but
yeah, no, later, the yeah. latest bloomer. So the thing I've been thinking about in relation to this deep dive, this question I've been asking myself is, was making quote unquote straight photographs, these sort of detached masculine views of the landscape. Was that, is there a relationship there? Like today, I appreciate the things I've learned from new topographics, but I'm not a person in the world who can afford to be detached or neutral or ambivalent, like sterile picture making. That's not my experience or identity. Like that's a privilege. Making those pictures is a privilege.
When you're referring to those pictures, you're referring to
white heterosexual men,
right?
And
working in a new topographic style, very kind of like a Robert Adams.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I really, really think, because Adams is so romantic, if you really like, if you read that reading, but, and Wessel doesn't belong there, in my mind, there's too much soul in his pictures.
Yeah, and playfulness. He's more in the Friedlander camp.
But when I really think about new topographics, I feel like that show was almost like built around Lewis Balzan, and then they pulled some other people in that, and then like, yeah. And when I think about Lewis Balzan, I think about this quote that I read, I don't know, maybe like 5 years ago, and it's Balzan, and he says something like, "All good art is without art or author." And I just think like, I love Lewis Balzan, but also fuck that.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that, I feel like that epitomizes when I'm talking about how this kind of neutrality and aloofness, that is a position of privilege that I don't have or want, and that I don't respond to anymore in the work of other people. But so I that's sort of my background foundation. I start grad school. I'm experimenting with work. And also, while I was in grad school, I got into, because I had been out for a year, maybe, and I've started grad school, and I got into what would be like my first and most significant, at least up until that point, gay relationship. And that ended, I made photographs of this person. That relationship ended as I was, like right before I finished grad school, I guess. And so my thesis show were all of these kind of eroded large format photographs of surfaces that didn't resonate with me because of anything ideologically related to new topographics, but because they resonated with me on like a spiritual or like a, it was empathy. I felt the way that those surfaces looked or something, which is sort of, I don't know, Stieglitzian, like photographic equivalency. So I did this thesis show that was all of that work. And then around the same time, a friend of mine who had a gallery space on the top floor of the women's building in this discrete kind of concrete box offered me a show. it's like, it was only enough room for like one or two people to be inside this space. It felt really intimate, but also the surface of this discrete concrete vault on the top floor felt sort of akin to the surfaces I was photographing that I was presenting in this thesis show. And I decided to use this structure as the armature in which to hang these photographs of this person that I was just heartbroken about. That was the moment where I think I realized I wanted to conflate architectural surface, landscape, and body. Mm-hmm. And so I think, and the project since then, so for, I don't know, 3 years now, has been that, this sort of more significant interest in the poetic and less so, yeah, making exhibitions of work that feel impenetrable or something.
I'm Jordan Weitzman, and you're listening to my conversation with Mark McKnight. To see more of Mark's work, follow us on Instagram at Magic Hour Podcast. This episode is kindly sponsored by Lightwork, a nonprofit that has been supporting artists working in photography since 1973. Lightwork hosts a world-renowned residency program and exhibitions, offers a community lab facility that's open to the public, and publishes Contact Sheet, one of the longest-running photography journals in the world. As a very special deal for listeners, take 10% off Contact Sheet subscriptions, signed books and prints from the Lightwork shop when you use the code MAGICHOUR at checkout. Subscriptions are just $40. Limited edition prints start at $300 with works by Jason Fulford, Zanelli Mahaly, Raymond Meeks, and many more. Support a great cause and begin or renew your subscription today at www.lightwork.org/shop.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
One thing is making the pictures, which is a very private, kind of solitary affair. And then there's the act of showing those pictures, which is a completely different, potentially very vulnerable activity, especially with the type of subject matter that you're dealing with. Do you feel that way at all? Or
do I feel vulnerable when I show the work?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
When you're gay and you repress certain things for so long, and then you come out and have and deal with them, there's a certain kind of, I don't know, gay fat that almost needs to be shed in a certain way. And I'm just curious if your work at all functions in a way to do that.
I hope it doesn't seem like a cop out to say. I just feel like that's like the kind of question, like, yeah, a psychiatrist would be like more equipped. Mm-hmm. I just for the first time started seeing, I'm seeing a therapist. Mm-hmm. And she's a psychodynamic, which means that's like Freud adjacent. Mm-hmm. Or something. And I almost want to bring in the work and be like, tell me more. And maybe I'll get to that point. And to this other thing we've discussed, like about the unconscious, I feel like my work continues to reveal more and mm-hmm. more to me the more time I spend with it. Mm-hmm. And the older I get, I feel like I'm actually of two minds, and there's a part of me that like doesn't want to betray the unconscious part of me and start saying that I know what my work is about, because who am I to say what my work is about?
Right.
In some ways, but like as stupid and ridiculous as that sounds, but also I'm like looking at two pictures right now, and there's a figure falling into a black abyssal shadow that they are casting, and you can't see their face. So they are staring into a kind of nothingness, or a reflection, or a shadow version of themselves. It was shot intentionally so as to look almost as if they were doing a kind of like ballet-esque kind of pirouette, in spite of the fact that they are larger in size. I know that feels queer to me, mm-hmm. but I couldn't exactly lay out exactly why that is and how it's related to my the specificity of my experiences, but I think it's undeniable. Mm-hmm. Is that fair? Does that sound like a cop out?
No, not at all. I guess I really just do have a fascination, well, with psychology in general.
Yeah.
But just talking about the manifestation of the unconscious and just psychological reads into work. And then not only that, even just personal experience, like how you feel in relation to the work that you're both making and showing. I mean, I guess that's kind of what I was just getting at.
I think I have a desire to make pictures that are claustrophobic. There's never a horizon. Mm. I want to use 4x5 cameras to have a lot of detail, but also I like to kind of break the rules of how you use a 4x5 and shoot like up or down, mm-hmm. in order to make the world feel like it's kind of folding in on itself. And I mean, how I felt.
Yeah.
Not only growing up, but into my mid-20s, you know, like, you're carrying a secret. You do feel folded in on yourself. And I'm trying to think of the last time I made a picture where you could see someone's face. It's like the subjects are hidden from us as much as I was hidden from me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I feel like that's almost really direct in a lot of ways, like in a way that I'm like not super. I'm like, wow, is it that easy to unpack this work? but I think I'm okay with that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's as much about, I think a lot of the pictures are as much about that as they are about like the body and my body and the kinds of men I'm frequently attracted to. And thinking about entropy, there's like, yeah. And I'm a part of me again is like, I'm always kind of second guessing myself. Is this pluralistic? Is that lazy? Or is that incredibly honest to admit that there are all of these things active in the work that can't always be 100% pinpointed?
Mm-hmm.
I think Paul Graham says this thing somewhere about all that shimmer of possibility work that like, and I hope I'm not blowing the way that he talks about it, but he says this thing about pinning the butterfly down. Mm-hmm. And that's not something I'm looking for. I don't want to like pin the butterfly down. I'm really interested in poetry and in the poetic, which is to say talking around a subject instead of pointing directly at it. And I think the worst thing in some ways that I could do is to say my work is just very specifically about this one thing, because like A, that would be disingenuous, but also B, I don't think it would be rewarding for anyone to walk into a show,
mm-hmm.
and be told what the, you know, like you don't ask a poet what they meant by the metaphor. You have the metaphor and you do with it whatever you want to do,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Yeah.
At the beginning, or I guess it would have been what, in February of 2018?
Mm-hmm.
So almost a year ago, I did this show. I think I sent you a poster for the If Water Forgets How to Play Mirror.
I love that poster.
And one of the sides of the poster is Eric, and he's like leaning back in this river in upstate New York, and he's like taking his shirt off and he's just covered in body hair and he's pissing into this like endless stream.
Yeah.
And that photograph is, I think the photograph, there's something jubilant about it to me, or at least that's what I was interested in conveying, but also it's really erotic. And that felt, I felt like I was really revealing something, mm-hmm. about my sexuality that even went beyond, it felt like slightly taboo. Like I couldn't find a poster place that would print it
really?
For a while. And then I finally got it printed and it just, that felt really liberating to be like, I made this picture this image is erotic to me. This experience was erotic to me. Like, and it's also beautiful.
Yeah.
And, yeah. That.
And sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but no, it's also, there's a perversion to it,
sure.
Which is, and I say that in the most positive kind of way. It's like, it's a certain kind of perversion that is, on the one hand, very subjective, like maybe, but also very relatable, but only, you know, maybe some people might relate to it, some might not. But you could see how an image like that may, you know, would be hard for, let's say, you might be uncomfortable with your parents seeing that image and displaying this almost this, I don't know, very private, personal kind of sense of eroticism or perversion.
It's so private. Yeah.
It's very private. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like, yeah, mom and dad, I'm gay. It's like, mom and dad, I'm gay. And
yeah,
I made this really sexy, like sexual photograph of, yeah, someone pissing,
yeah,
into a river.
Yeah.
But I invited my parents,
yeah,
to the show. Uh-huh. They didn't go to the opening, and I did forewarn them. I was just like, there's a lot of nudity and it gets kind of sexy. And I didn't think they were going to go. And then one day, without telling me, they went by the gallery, and they, both of my parents, went and saw the show.
Mm-hmm.
And which was like incredibly sweet and supportive. And my dad didn't say anything. He told my mom how proud he was of me,
mm-hmm,
but he and I never really talked about, mm-hmm, the work, and that's totally okay. But yeah, that felt really liberating too.
Did you talk about it with your mom at all?
Yeah. She said it was beautiful.
Yeah.
But she didn't, we didn't talk about like,
mm-hmm,
water sports or like, you know what I mean? It was just like, I think that she probably put two and two together.
Yeah.
I
feel I have a similar kind of experience with both my parents, like a bit more open with my mom. My dad doesn't ask too many questions.
Yeah. But even the fact,
comfortable, like cool, but not like, doesn't like to talk about it too much.
But even the fact, yeah, but it's about you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Or us. It's like you make the work, and there's this great thing where you're willing to show it regardless,
mm-hmm,
of what someone's going to think about it.
Yeah. And I almost feel that it extends beyond that to this necessity that that we might have that has to do with being gay and has to do with, again, not to get, I mean, I hope it's not too psychological and personal, but it has to do with being gay and repressing something. Like when you repress something and you come out of it, you almost have this need to be a little bit more extreme in your demonstration of these kinds of things.
And that manifests, I think, yeah.
It comes out in the pictures. Yeah, it's like, you know, you're not making things to, you know, to necessarily shock for shock's sake or show something that is...
For me, it's like unapologetic declaration.
Unapologetic declaration.
And I have to force myself to make that declaration because I spent so long not making it.
Exactly.
That even if I know I'm going to be uncomfortable,
yeah,
I have to constantly allow myself to do the things that I would never do before in order to force growth,
exactly,
in certain spheres.
Yeah. I'm curious how you think about the landscape or the unpeopled pictures and the types of qualities that you look for in them. What kind of, like, I mean, what do you want the unpeopled pictures to do, or how do you want them to function?
That photograph that was on the table when you walked in, the title for it is Flesh. And it's just a ripped bag of asphalt,
mm-hmm,
that I found on a long drive out to Ventura, actually in pursuit of a completely different landscape photograph that I didn't get that day. I ended up seeing that on the side of the road. And when I drove by, I think possibly because I had just been out at the ocean in Ventura, I had like ocean on my mind, and I wasn't actually near the coast at this point, but I saw this ripped bag of asphalt and it looked like a beached, like rotted whale. it just looked fleshly because the outside of the bag was slightly wet, and it's corporeal. It looked to me like animal flesh that, and like the, it looked like entrails were being sort of eviscerating, but it's just asphalt exiting a bag. And I think I'm interested in finding things like that where I can draw formal and figurative parallels between body, architecture, object, landscape, so that there is maybe a kind of collapse between those things.
Mm-hmm.
And one can see them poetically, but also I can talk about these larger, I can use these subjects as armatures for bigger ideas like entropy.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've always been like, I was always that like weird kid that was like thinking about mortality, you know, at like age 9 or something mm-hmm. like that. It's just something I think about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was like the first art that you saw that you really, where you were like, wow, like I want to do that, or like that made you want to be an artist?
The show that I really think back about, there was like a Tillman's survey.
Mm.
And I remember going to see the show alone, not really knowing that much about his work at that point. I was probably 21 or 22 at the oldest. And in the middle of the show, I'm not sure if I've ever told anyone this, in the middle of the show, there's this photograph of all of these men, and they're like, they're just kind of like draped on each other. Like they're like leaning their heads on each other's shoulders, and they just completely fill this frame, and it was printed really large, and it's a Tillman show. So there's just, and I'm standing there looking at the picture, and this is years before I would even come out, and I started crying.
Mm.
And I think that's maybe the only time I've cried in a museum, you know? Mm. And I think that show actually made a really big impact on me in ways that I don't even think were conscious until maybe more years later.
It's amazing when those things happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't think
it's so visceral. Like, yeah.
And I don't even think I could identify why I was crying. I think I was just so overwhelmed. Now it's so easy to see why I was overwhelmed,
mm-hmm.
you know, and like why that was so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. How do you, are the people you photograph, who are the people that you photograph?
Boyfriend, close friends, people that were comfortable in front of the camera and fit the sort of like archetype I'm frequently looking for, which is bodies that are not dissimilar from mine, mm-hmm. I think. And in that way, I think the pictures are like these proxies. And I'm concerned this is going to sound so narcissistic, but it's like the type of body I'm attracted to frequently, but also these bodies resemble my own.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens, and it's someone that's comfortable kind of like being photographed, especially if they're willing to like be photographed in the nude. Yeah, that's, I guess, what I'm looking for. But yeah, mostly friends.
Mm-hmm. Well, the act of it is a pretty intimate one.
There's a lot of trust involved in that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've never taken my clothes off for those people who have thought this before. The pictures are never of me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hmm. If anyone out there is listening, it's not me. but sometimes when I'm printing in the dark room, a stranger will be like, is that you? And I'm like, no, it's not me. But I love that there's that confusion, because that is sort of the point.
Mm. Thanks so much for having me here. I mean, it's been a really great pleasure talking.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was my conversation with Mark McKnight that we recorded in LA. This episode was produced by me, Jordan Weitzman, and was edited by Crystal Duhame. Music on this episode by Adam Feingold. To find out more about the show, visit us at magichourpodcast.org and follow us on Instagram at magichourpodcast. Thanks for tuning in, and see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.